is Bean to Barstool, a podcast that looks at the intersections of craft beer and craft chocolate. My name is David Nilsson. I'm a professional beer writer and an advanced Cicerone, and the creator and host of this show. The music for this episode is by my dear friend, indie folk musician Anna P.S. You can find out more about Anna's music in the show notes or at her website, annapsmusic.com. You can find links and information about our guests in the show notes as well. I hope you enjoy this episode of Bean to Barstool. Chocolate is a plant-based food or drink in which the main ingredient, the seed of a tropical tree, is ground and melted and mixed into something wholly new. Sometimes spices or botanicals are added, and in the past, this was all done by hand. It sounds almost like making a potion, right? That's certainly what some folks in 17th and 18th century Mexico and Central America thought. It turns out many women were prosecuted at that time for reportedly casting spells with chocolate or outright poisoning people with chocolate potions. In the last episode, we spoke with Dr. Christina Wade about the connections between medieval alewives, female brewers who made part or all of their living brewing and selling unhopped beer known at the time as ale, and our modern depictions of fairy tale witches with cauldrons, cats, broomsticks, and pointy hats. And we found out from Dr. Wade that there is no such connection. It's a fanciful modern story that serves to bring some attention to the very real lives of women at a certain time in the past, but doesn't actually reflect historical reality. Today we're going to talk about chocolate-making women from previous centuries who were directly accused of witchcraft, and find out if those accusations were founded in any way. Grab yourself some tasty bean-to-bar chocolate and follow along for this spellbinding tale. In issue 3 of Cacao Magazine, published in the fall of 2020, chocolate writer and friend of the show, Megan Giller, wrote an article titled Poison Your Lover with Chocolate and Other Advice from 17th Century Witches. She told of a string of cases in which women were accused of malicious chocolate-related misdoings, usually of the supernatural kind. As we head into autumn and approach Halloween, Samhain, and Dia de los Muertos, I felt like it was the perfect time to reach out to Megan and ask her about this fascinating story from chocolate history. Megan previously appeared in episode 2 of Bean to Barstool, where we discussed the differences in how we talk about and describe beer and chocolate, and how these two artisan fields can learn from the sensory language of the other. I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes so you can hear more of Megan's insights. Join me now as Megan and I discuss the historical connection between chocolate making and witchcraft. So Megan, why don't you share with us a little bit about what you're currently working on?
Yeah, so I actually went back to grad school. I'm in an MFA program at the New School for Creative Writing. So that's been really exciting.
Of course,
I'm spending a lot of time thinking about chocolate as well. So I'm writing a little bit less about chocolate, but I've been leading private chocolate tastings quite a bit for, it's been all virtual in the past year, but it's starting to return to New York City a little bit. So that has been very exciting and fun to share really great chocolate and the stories around it with so many people.
Yeah, for sure. So last year, in issue 3 of Cacao Magazine, you wrote an article titled Poison Your Lover with Chocolate and Other Advice from 17th Century Witches. Can you share a little bit of the background of that article and what got you interested in that topic?
Sure. That title always cracks me up. I was very happy when I thought of Poison Your Lover with Chocolate. Yeah. So, I mean, basically several years ago, I was looking into stories about women and chocolate, and I really didn't know exactly what I was looking for, but I knew something historical. And so I started asking academics that I knew if they could point me in the right direction. And Catherine Sampeck, who is at Illinois State University and has studied chocolate for a long time, kind of pointed me to a couple scholarly articles that she thought that I would think were interesting. And I read them and just thought they were completely wild. The stories in them are just, you know, crazy. And something I'd never heard before about women and chocolate and witchcraft, and actually thousands of women being prosecuted for all of this kind of stuff, you know, hundreds of years ago in Central and South America. So that's where it started. And then nothing ended up happening with it right after that. But I ended up coming back to that story for this little web series I made called What Women Ate, because I just couldn't stop thinking about these like wild stories I'd read about these witches or supposed witches. And then I knew that when Cacao Magazine was doing their issue all around women, I was like, well, I love these stories so much. What do you think about me writing about them again? And they said yes. So it's sure. very good. Yeah.
You mentioned this was in Central America, looking at 17th and 18th century. Can you share a little bit of why the focus was limited to that geography and that time period? What was going on in Mexico and Central America at that time?
Yeah, well, I mean, in Mexico, Guatemala, and Belize specifically, those are where we have accounts of this happening. So, I mean, first, more people were drinking chocolate during that time. It had moved. I mean, I guess there's some debate about whether people of all classes and castes had been drinking chocolate forever or if this was something new. But by that point, it was more of an everyday drink and accessible to people. And then on top of that, the Spanish Inquisition was going on. So all of these people, all of these women were actually, and some men were actually prosecuted by these Spanish courts. And so that's a big reason why we have the records of it, because it comes straight from the Inquisition courts. And I guess it's also worth noting that they only prosecuted people who were of Spanish descent or Spaniards. So, you know, anyone indigenous would not have been included in the record. So we don't know what happened with all of those millions of people.
So it just wasn't recorded. It's not necessarily that they weren't falling victim to this witch hunt.
That's right. They weren't necessarily prosecuted in a formal court, but they probably were punished by society or their community or, you know, something else. And we don't know. We can't reconstruct what happened.
Sure. Well, let's look at one specific example. You mentioned in 1762, a Maria Maldonado. Can you share a little bit of her story and her ultimate fate?
Yeah. So she was a wealthy woman, and one of her lady's maids named Maria de Casanova accused her of witchcraft. And so Maria de Casanova said that Maria Maldonado, who was the lady of the house, had basically gotten her to bring four witches to the house and come up with a spell to make someone, a guy, fall in love with her. Mm-hmm. And so there's even a record of the recipe, and it includes all sorts of things you would not want in your chocolate, like pubic hair and fingernail clippings and part of your clothing, that you need to burn them and then put the ashes into the chocolate.
Those are not the inclusions we're looking for in our
right. Yeah. Maybe not the inclusions that we enjoy today, but there is actually a spell that Maria de Casanova actually like said in court. Like, this is the spell that we were supposed to say. And it was, on two, I see you, on five, I take you, I break your heart, I drink your blood. By the peace of the Queen of the Angels and her precious son, you are with me. So If anyone wants to practice this magic, they now have all the ingredients.
Is there any record or indication of what motivated Maria de Casanova to accuse the lady of the house?
You know, I don't think there is much, but if you're kind of reading between the lines, a lot of these accusations came when there were power imbalances, whether it was, you know, a servant who worked for someone, or there was a racial or kind of like caste difference. And it really made people with privilege kind of scared, actually, of what someone might say about them. Because if they were accused, then their privilege almost didn't matter at that point. So it was a real way of getting even. I mean, you also saw a lot of friends accusing each other. So yeah, it really exacerbated the power dynamics that were already behind relationships.
Did that go the other direction at all? Did you see people in power kind of subjugating the lower classes with that threat?
You know, I'm sure that did happen, but I didn't find as many examples of that. I guess the one example that I don't know if you could argue this is power or not, but, you know, it's definitely a gender difference. So all of these nuns in Chiapas, Mexico, were accused of poisoning the priest. And it really, I think the story is that it came about because they were drinking chocolate during mass. And the priest was like, you know, you need to stop that. You need to pay attention. And so then supposedly they poisoned him and then got their way and got to drink chocolate during mass.
Awesome.
Yeah.
You mentioned that this was mostly happening to women. There were a few men. You and I have spoken before that even today, there is sort of a gendered connotation around chocolate and this like assumed association between women and chocolate. It sounds like that carried back centuries to when this was happening.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, women were mainly the people preparing all the food, especially chocolate. So that's part of how that association came to be at that time. But, you know, I think chocolate was also a really good vehicle to hide something in, because it was dark and, you know, muddled. So you could put whatever you wanted in there or accuse someone of putting whatever you wanted in there. I mean, there are cases of men being accused as well, but that is a whole kind of separate topic that deserves its own article and like podcast about why and like what positions of power they were in and that kind of stuff.
With liquid chocolate being such a good vehicle for that, do you have the impression that this was actually happening in some cases of people really using chocolate for whether it's for spell making or potion making or whatever it is?
We'll be right back.
Hey everyone. Fifth Street Brew Pub in Dayton, Ohio is one of our sponsors at Bean to Barstool and Final Gravity, our print beer zine, and they just happen to be one of my favorite hometown breweries. They're one of the only cooperatively owned breweries in the country, a testament to their community focus and support. Inside a building from the 1850s in the historic neighborhood of St. Anne's Hill, Fifth Street Brew Pub offers a warm, cozy atmosphere and excellent beer and food. And you can take your favorite beers to go with their Gem City Swing Tops, elegant swing top bottles filled straight from the taps with regular favorites like St. Anne's Pills and Rough Gem Farmhouse Ale, or current seasonals like Noel Belgian Dark Ale with vanilla and cinnamon, or Velvet Anxiety, a bourbon barrel imperial stout brewed with cacao nibs from Mezzo Cacao. If you're in the Dayton area, head over to Fifth Street to hang out or grab beer to go. And if you're visiting Dayton, and you should, make sure Fifth Street is on your list. Cheers.
I mean, I think people probably were putting stuff in chocolate and or casting spells. I don't know if they actually used these pretty gross ingredients that are supposedly used in all of the documents. But, or if it, you know, that was kind of this figment of the imagination or kind of nightmares, you know, that people are like, oh, and then all this disgusting stuff is in there. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that it's all of these parts of women that we tend to ignore as a society or like don't want to acknowledge. And that's what's going in the chocolate, you know?
That's interesting. Sure.
But, yeah. But I do think that there was some amount of it going on, and whether it worked or not is a different question.
Sure. Do we have any documented cases of someone being poisoned by this way?
I mean, the nuns did poison. I believe that the bishop, I think I said he was a priest, but he was a bishop. I mean, he became very ill. So whether it was really from the chocolate or something else, we don't know. So I don't know if there's a case where it's like cut and dried that someone really was poisoned.
Don't try to take people's chocolate away.
That's right. I know. I'm very serious about that.
Yeah. So this wasn't just limited to Mexico, as you said. There was another story in your article from 1695 in Guatemala.
Yeah. And that is one of my favorite stories, actually, just because, you know, I was talking about how women were the ones who were preparing food and chocolate in particular. But so in this court case, it was reversed. The husband was preparing chocolate for his wife to drink in bed, and he used that as evidence that he must have been bewitched, because otherwise, why would he possibly serve someone else? And it's especially in bed, that just seems like adding insult to injury. So he said that his wife had bewitched him. And it wasn't just that, it was the official quote is, so that he could not be a man on all the occasions that he desired to have intercourse with his wife. So he had a little bit of a erectile dysfunction problem. So
and created an elaborate excuse to exactly not his problem. Sure.
It couldn't not possibly have been something going on with him. It was that his wife had clearly bewitched him in all these evil ways.
And did the court fall for that?
I mean, yeah, the woman, her name was Cecilia, she was convicted and she went to jail, and she supposedly brought a bunch of chocolate with her to jail.
I spoke with Dr. Christina Wade. She is a historian looking at the history of brewing in Europe, specifically in Ireland right now. And we were talking about the history of some witch trials there that were brought against some female brewers during the medieval era. And there's some evidence that some of those accusations might have been motivated from a business standpoint to try to get women out of commercial brewing as it became more commercially viable. Do you see any sort of culturally consistent motivations for how this was being used? You mentioned kind of to level the playing field a little bit, but was there anything kind of behind that, or was this more misogyny for its own sake, or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe more misogyny for its own sake, because so many of these drinks were made in homes, right? They weren't made for the most part in businesses, or I didn't see a lot of cases where it was cafes or anything like that. I mean, there's obviously economics at work because people are employed by others who are accusing them or vice versa, but it does seem like it's something very much on the home front. But I mean, I think it points, you know, a lot, it explains a lot about what's going on kind of underneath things with their society. And I'll just read you what Martha Few wrote in her article, Chocolate Sex and Disorderly Women in Late 17th and Early 18th Century Guatemala. And she says that chocolate acted as a central vehicle of women's ritual power and was a flashpoint for women's disorderly behavior in public settings. So it was a way to punish women, but not necessarily from a business angle or to drive them out of some industry.
Can you clarify a little bit what it would mean to have been making chocolate at this point? I guess we haven't explained what that would have looked like for somebody to be doing this in the home. How was chocolate being consumed, and what would it have meant to be making and preparing that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, I honestly don't know if they would have been making it from scratch, but there's kind of two parts to making chocolate, right? Some of them probably were starting with cocoa beans that they would have to shell themselves. So, you know, take the husk off and then grind them down on a metate, which takes hours and hours and hours. And so at that point, they would be formed into cocoa balls or cocoa sticks, depending on where you were, Central or South America. I don't know if you've seen that or if people who are listening have seen it, but it's either a ball or kind of a long stick that's really pretty solid chocolate. It's 100% and it's roughly ground. And with the balls, you can drop them in liquid and mix it up using like a molinillo, or with the sticks, a lot of times you'll grate some into the water or milk. At this point, it would have definitely been water. Chocolate was most likely a pretty savory drink at that point too. So it's a lot of labor to produce chocolate. And it's not as easy as obviously heating up some Swiss Miss in the microwave, which is what we can do now if we choose to, I guess.
When you say savory, do you mean it actually would have been spiced in a more savory way?
Yeah, it would have been spiced. It would have had achiote and black pepper and spicy peppers. And I believe that they probably were using honey and maybe some sugar at that point, but I think sugar was still pretty expensive. So I'm not sure the everyday person would have been using something like that to sweeten their chocolate. Because, you know, chocolate was always a savory drink until it made its way to Europe. And that's when some form of sugar started being added.
So this chocolate would have been a staple in most households, at least of a certain income level, presumably?
Yeah, that's right. They would have, and you know, some people actually used it as part of their meal or like a meal replacement sort of thing. Like, it's not mentioned in these scholarly articles, but in that area of the world, people will mix corn of various varieties with chocolate. So it's almost more like a porridge that will be thicker or thinner depending on where you are. And so that will kind of sustain you. It's usually you drink it in the morning, sustains you for a good part of the day.
So we talked about some of the specific stories in your article. I'd love for you to just share a few of your other favorites, whether from the article or ones you weren't able to include.
I mean, I think the story about Cecilia really is my favorite because it's just so juicy. You know, like you don't really read documents from the 17th century that often that talk about like impotence, you know, it's always kind of implied, but in a lot of things, but you know, there's so many stories of like the conquistadors trying to find like, you know, something that solved impotence and constipation. It's like everything they came across was tried to solve those two things. But I love that story in particular.
So Megan, are there any modern connections that we see between spiritual practice and the use of cacao or chocolate?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there are point blank comparisons between what people were doing then and what people are doing now. I do think that there's still kind of this tendency to gender food and especially chocolate. And one thing that I think Joan Bristol and Matthew Restall write really well about is about like these fears around women spiking hot chocolate weren't really about that. They were about women's changing roles in society. And I think that's still true about our preoccupations with a lot of food, among other things. And just, you know, that women who didn't fit within a certain status quo were prosecuted, whether it was then or now, in different ways. But I think the thing that kind of overlaps to me is this whole trend of ceremonial cacao, which isn't necessarily specific to women, but is popping up everywhere. Ceremonial cacao, it seems like, started with these cacao ceremonies in North America and Europe that I don't know very much about whether they're related to real ceremonies that would take place in Central and South America, but it's now morphed into a lot of shops that offer chocolate bars and confections and all sorts of things that are supposedly made with ceremonial grade cacao, although I, to be honest, have no idea what that really means. But there is still this, you know, connection with this mysticism and some sort of indigenous culture that they're kind of, I don't know, they're crafting this story around that in ceremonial cacao.
You and I have spoken previously about the way that chocolate does seem to evoke some fanciful language from us. Like, it kind of puts us in the mindset of doing that. I wonder if they're just trying to sort of corral that into something organized.
I think so. And also that a lot of times it's not described as chocolate, even if it is a hot chocolate or chocolate bar, or even, like, you know, a truffle or bonbon, it's actually described as cacao, which I think evokes something a little bit different for people and something more mysterious and wild for some reason.
With that gendered connection between women and chocolate, I think that's something that most of us recognize broadly. Are there specific ways that you think that impacts craft chocolate, like ways that we see that playing out, that connection?
Well, I mean, women are definitely seen as the main consumers of chocolate. If you look at commercials around chocolate, for example, I think that's, you know, it's always this, I'm talking about mainstream chocolate now, but it's always a woman very seductively devouring a piece of chocolate, right? But I think that spills over into craft chocolate. And I do think it's interesting that it's still a very male-dominated industry, but that we assume the consumer is always female. And in that way, we haven't really broken from commercial chocolate brands at all. But then when you do look, I mean, I don't have information about specific brands' customers, but even looking at my blog, like, I would say the majority of readers are female. And so it is interesting that there is kind of this big divide.
Yeah, for sure. Changing subjects to a little bit lighter note, as the seasons change into fall, what are some of your favorite fall seasonal chocolates or traditions or experiences around chocolate that you like to have as it starts getting colder?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely always excited for drinking chocolate. That's something that you don't really want in the dead of summer, but unless it's iced, and then it is very delicious. Yeah. But warm drinking chocolate, I'm very much looking forward to that. And then, you know, I think I just bake a lot more in the fall and then around the holidays. And of course, it's with chocolate. My mother-in-law always makes the chocolate chip cookie recipe from my book when we go back to their house for the holidays. So I'm, of course, looking forward to that. But it's a little bit more hardcore everything chocolate in my house, even the dough, right? So sure. So that will be coming up very soon too. And of course, I mean, you know, it's a strange thing to look forward to Halloween when you're in the craft chocolate world, because, you know, most of the chocolate featured is commercial chocolate, but I always love handing out candy to kids and also thinking about, I mean, it seems like more people are thinking about chocolate during that time. So it's a little bit easier to connect with people around it and give them chocolate that, you know, I feel like is equitably made.
Megan's chocolate chip cookie recipe is a favorite in our house, and you can find it in her excellent book, Bean to Bar Chocolate, America's Craft Chocolate Revolution. I'll link to her website in the show notes. Our own fall traditions tend to include great fall beers like pumpkin ales and Oktoberfest lagers, and of course, plenty of good chocolate. We love using Bean to Bar Chocolate in fancy s'mores, and I'm working on putting together some great s'mores recipes for an upcoming project. We recently drove to Fibonacci Brewing in Cincinnati for their autumnal equinox party and spent a lovely fall day in their grassy beer garden shaded by towering oak, maple, and black walnut trees. We drank their fresh hop ale made with local hops and their Pepo pumpkin porter brewed with locally grown pumpkins. In the evening, they lit the campfires and we sipped pumpkin beer and made s'mores with chocolate from Cultura Chocolate in Colorado. It was a beautiful start to autumn. Whatever your fall traditions, I hope they include good friends and the bewitching potions of your own choosing. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Bean to Barstool.